It's time for another episode of The Accidental Entrepreneur.
We don't have a road to, not every kid should go to college. We don't seem to have much of a road. Is that something I'm missing and we do have?
That's exactly. So we have a report out there called the Education Equation, which this task force put together. This is exactly to the point that you're saying. This is not a one size fits all. And candidly, we did not do well by at least one generation, if not two decades of students coming up by saying, you must go to college or you won't be successful. Right. You know, a lot of kids are not cut out for that and put on the right pathway. We have tens of thousands of vacant jobs today, middle level skilled jobs, like those electricians, those plumbers, the trades, right? Where you can't fill those jobs and they pay middle income wages where you could afford to live, work, and raise a family in New Jersey.
Right, union benefits and all that type of stuff.
Absolutely. So our report talks to that and the importance that we get back there. And again, and this is the whole thing of being honest. Look, I have now 27-year-old twins, right? When they were coming up, I did the, you know, you will go to college. When I went to law school, I'm a lifelong learner. I believe in the value of education.
Right.
But you know what? It doesn't have to be like this, right? That trajectory that we all follow, right? You can step on and off. You can get credentials and you can get certificates that say, I know how to make or build or run this widget.
Right.
And I can work with that, right? I can make some money and then I can continue to build those credentials toward a degree.
Right.
That's the real way. And that's an affordable way to get a post-secondary education. We have that challenge.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I think with all this stuff going on in the pandemic, I think a lot of parents and children are coming to the reality of
the information provided in these episodes is for entertainment purposes only. It is not a guarantee of success or to be construed as advice of any kind. You should always seek advice from local licensed professionals before making any decisions.
The dictionary defines an entrepreneur as a person who organizes and manages any enterprise, especially a business, usually with considerable initiative and risk. People often start a business without much choice, perhaps due to a job loss or just being dissatisfied at work, and they come up with an idea they just know can be successful. They become entrepreneurs by accident. That is to say, their success or failure happens by accident, not with intention. My name is Mitch Beinhacker. I'm a corporate attorney and a business advisor. You're listening to The Accidental Entrepreneur, my podcast about how to achieve success on purpose, not by accident. Join me along with our monthly guests where we share our knowledge and help you get a hold of your business. And now on to today's episode.
Hi, my name is Michelle Sikirka. I'm the president and CEO of the New Jersey Business and Industry Association. We are the largest member association, not just in New Jersey, but in the country, representing 1 million jobs across the state of New Jersey.
All right. So thanks so much. I know we've been trying to do this and putting it off and you've been real busy, but I appreciate you squeezing me in because you're probably busier now than before this all started, jumping on the podcast with me. Yeah. So it is the early days in May. We are probably maybe, I don't know, 2 weeks from starting to come out of our hiding. Maybe we want to go back a little bit and talk about, you know, how you got involved with what you do. Because I know you used to practice law back in the late 80s and 90s, right? You were a litigator. And then you got involved with a lot of stuff, including the state DEP, right?
Yeah.
Now you're heading NJBIA. So maybe you want to take me through that a little bit.
Sure. The Reader's Digest version of the Michelle Sikirka story.
Right.
I'm an attorney by trade. Yes, right. I was in private practice for about 12 and a half years, predominantly business and employment law. And at that 12 and a half year mark, I was offered an opportunity to become the vice president of employee relations with AAA, which was then Central West Jersey. So a geographic club here in New Jersey. Who then within a year merged with larger AAA Mid-Atlantic. I moved over to become senior legal counsel in Mid-Atlantic.
Okay, I saw that on your resume. I didn't know if you moved to another AAA or basically a merger.
It was a merger, yeah, and then I moved over. So I was senior legal counsel and had some absolutely great opportunities there. When they moved our headquarters, so actually my headquarters moved from right in my backyard in Mercer County to Philadelphia. And then they moved the headquarters to Delaware. Okay. And at the time, my then 12-year-old twins in about sixth grade, you know, we were very committed to our community. I served on the school board and all those things. I just couldn't do a commute to Delaware every day. It wasn't going to work.
Right.
And at that time, our regional chamber of commerce had a leadership void. And I was actually the incoming chair of the chamber of commerce. Okay. And I had an opportunity to join a law firm or to become the business advocate. And, you know, business advocacy has really been my passion. And so that's when I took the jump into the trade association.
And that was in Mercer County?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It was the Mercer Regional Chamber of Commerce, okay, which now today is merged into the Princeton Mercer Regional Chamber of Commerce.
So, but that's the whole county?
It is broader than a county. It's regional. Yeah. Oh, so okay. It bends over into Middlesex and a little bit into Burlington. And yeah.
Okay.
And so after 6.5 years there, we were seeing the out-migration in New Jersey business, right, leaving New Jersey as well as money. That was significant concern to us. And we said if the right person stands himself up for governor, it's important for us to get on that bandwagon, a pro-business candidate. Right. That candidate was Chris Christie.
Right.
And I got involved in his policy, served on policy committees during his campaign. Obviously, you know how that story ends. He got elected, served right, 2 terms. And I joined his administration. I was at DEP. My first position at DEP was the Assistant Commissioner for Economic Growth and Green Energy. And then I was the Assistant Commissioner for Water Resource Management. And my last almost 2 years, I was Deputy Commissioner, so number two at DEP.
And you didn't really have much of an environmental background, did you? I mean,
No. I was, and that's why my role there, the policy position that I was serving during that time was the responsible red tape position. So it's basically how do we cut regulatory red tape and bureaucracy in a responsible manner? And so I literally was the voice for business at DEP, ensuring that responsible projects could get a pathway to being completed.
Got it. Right. Because environmental issues are often a obstacle. I work in a lot of commercial jobs and it's often a problem. You know, people don't understand wetlands and all this different stuff that occur on a property that really, it's not something you did necessarily. It's just something that developed.
But what we understand is, so my position was all about sustainability. And we know sustainability is the equitable balance of economy, environment, and people. And right, that's exactly the role I served there. And then as deputy commissioner, I oversaw about 12 post-Sandy programs. So I lived through Sandy right, at DEP. That was an extraordinary time. I thought I'd seen it all, living through Sandy, and then look at where we are today.
No, it's like, yeah. If you think that's the craziest time in your life, looking back, and then this happens.
Exactly.
I mean, I can't even imagine. Okay, so then when did you join mm-hmm. NJBIA?
Yeah, so after 4.5 years in the administration, so I came to BIA at the tail end last quarter of 2014. So I'm actually there 5.5 years, which is extraordinary. I can't believe how fast the time has gone.
Sure. And I think NJBIA is the largest, right, business and industry association in the state?
Or yeah, actually in the country. Representing businesses, not individuals. We represent a whole company. So yes, mm-hmm, absolutely.
Got it. Okay. So yeah, so your members are companies.
Correct.
The only individuals who are members are people that are one person companies, really, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, we have sole proprietors and independent contractors for sure. But, you know, we represent those who run the companies.
Okay. So why don't we talk about what NJBIA does and what you've been doing? So you said you're 14, so you've been there about 6 years, right?
Yeah. Five. October was five, so 5.5, yeah.
Okay. And what NJBIA does and what you want it to do, and more importantly, like what role is it playing with all this craziness that's going on?
Yeah. So in an ordinary world, actually, we're 110 years old and we were born and bred out of manufacturing. And so if you go back to Trenton, during an industrializing New Jersey, 110 right, years ago, manufacturing was it.
Right.
So if you think of the Roebling Steels, right, those are the men, because it was men at that time, who actually created the organization. And we were the New Jersey Manufacturing Association in our first instance.
Okay.
Of course, over the century and decades, we came to represent, you know, all business and industry, because New Jersey became all business and industry, and we kept up with that.
Right.
At the heart of our work is advocacy for an affordable and regionally competitive New Jersey, one where we can create jobs every day and sustain businesses and gain financial success for those businesses. And through that, we provide member services in addition to our advocacy. So we have a government affairs team that lobbies, you know, for business in the state, pretty much, you know, lives at the state house, tracking policy and advancing good policy and then defending against bad policy and mitigating policy on behalf of business. And then on the member services side, we do a lot with education. So certainly seminars right now, or webinars. We do a lot with workforce development because it's not only important to sustain jobs, but we need to fill them. And so we, unfortunately, without migration in New Jersey, particularly 18 to 34 year olds, we have a challenging workforce. And so we play a very, very pivotal role in workforce development as well.
So like training people for different industries or?
Yeah. And just advancing the cause as well. You know, what do we need for a good workforce in the state of New Jersey? What are the skill sets of tomorrow? And most importantly, we have a post-secondary education task force, which is a task force comprised of business, academia, nonprofits, students, all across the board who are talking about a K-16 approach to how do we prepare the next generation workforce. Because usually on any given day, the number one concern in New Jersey business, aside from the cost of doing business, is attracting a workforce at the ready, given the skill sets that we need today.
Right. Well, it's, you know, it's a difficult part of the country to live in. I mean, I have three kids and I'm an attorney, small business attorney, basically on my own. I deal with small business owners. This is an expensive part of the country to live in. And a lot of industries and people are going other places because they just can't deal with the cost of living that
100%
to batter them, you know, with housing and I mean everything. It's just nuts. What's NJBIA advocating to help relieve that, I guess? You can't fix it, but it's, you know, we got a long way to go.
Right, but we can mitigate against it. And so I'll give you an easy example over the last couple of years with this administration. Certainly when Governor Murphy ran as candidate Murphy, he was very clear about what he was going to do in New Jersey, right?
Right.
He said, I'm going to get, I'm going to increase paid sick leave and family leave, and I'm going to boost minimum wage. Like, we knew those things were coming at us. And so what could we do in that situation? We can mitigate those policies so that they come on in a progressive and iterative manner so that business can keep up with it, right?
Right.
So the rising to $15, you know, certainly the governor in his first instance wanted an immediate 15. We're like, business can't sustain that.
Companies will go out of business, sure. Exactly. Or cut their workforce in half or whatever.
Exactly. And so policies like that, or even, you know, paid sick leave, the first paid sick leave policy had a mandated 80 hours. We got it down to 40 hours. You know, so these are things that while you know what's coming at you, you can help to mitigate the impact on business.
Right.
But we do work tirelessly to push off mandates that cost business money, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem, right? It's a balance, right? So you want the employees to be taken care of, but you don't want to do it at the detriment of companies going under, because that's not going to help the employees if they're out of work or the
Absolutely.
Workforce cuts in half.
Absolutely. And this goes back to the workforce development, because The way to raise wages is organically through workforce training.
Right.
Nobody wants to lose employees when they make the investment in training a workforce, right? It costs a lot to have turnover. And so people, for the most part, want to see their employees rise up through a company. And so when you build their skills, they earn more money.
So how do you do that? Like, how do you help them with workforce training? You offered seminars and training in certain industries. Do you go to companies to do things? How do you?
Yeah, so there's a few things. We actually, years ago, we were the impetus to a certain grant program in the state, which is for basic skills. And that definition is very, very broad. It could be everything as English as a second language to some basic programming. That is customized training that the community colleges deliver, and it can be delivered either at the college or on the work site. So that's an easy example. Okay. But the other thing, and the heart of it again, is bringing together business and academia so that business can help to inform academia of what skill sets are needed to be at the ready, so that then academia can go back and teach to that. That's how you build a workforce, is we're creating the connectivity and the partnership.
Yeah, because I think that sometimes academia misses that. They're all about academia and teaching, and this is the way you teach, and you learn this subject. But if people aren't ready for whatever's going on in the workforce, I think a lot of jobs that are eliminated, they're not really eliminated, they just change.
And that's not a knock. I mean, that's certainly not a knock on academia at all. Reality is they're not out in the workforce, and so they're not seeing the dynamic change every day, right? I call it boots on the ground. You have to go into the industry and understand, you know, how that's changing. Then you need to help have people who are teaching those skill sets, right? They have to keep up their skills as well. And so the more that we can do train the trainer, for example, you know, the more that business can partner with teachers and academia in order to teach certain skills, that's how we make a workforce at the ready.
Yeah, you know, I ran I wish I still did it. I did it for about 4 or 5 years. We ran an entrepreneurs academy for young kids.
Yeah.
I mean, like middle school and high school kids. students, and they were they literally would leave with an active business. And one of the reasons we did it was, I think a lot of the kids in high school, not post-secondary, but in high school, you know, they're still being taught like it's 1945. There's no, you know, and because you know, a lot of the faculty are not business people. I mean, there's some faculty that are, but for the most people, they're not. And a lot of these kids don't, you know what to do and how to even start a business, or it didn't make a lot of sense. So we used to teach them about cost of goods sold versus actually running a business and the costs and how you start. And then we'd have a little pitch deck, like a, like a Shark Tank. And they would get some money and they would get started. It was, I kind of volunteered my way out of practice. So it was harder to keep it going, but we did it 4 or 5 years with Gene and with the chamber and so forth. But it was, you know, it's hard to see the kids. It's frustrating to see the kids go through a curriculum like, and not, you know, only be some, I mean, they really need college to be ready for the next stage. You know, it's difficult.
And it articulates. That's why we say it's a K-16 and beyond strategy, because it articulates from day one.
Yeah. It seems to me, and maybe you have a better handle on this, that a lot of the vocations, let's call them, like plumbing and electricians and things like that, doesn't seem to be, it seems to be like a dying art. We don't have a road to, not every kid should go to college. We don't seem to have much of a road. Is that something I'm missing? And we do have.
That's exactly. So we have a report out there called the Education Equation, which this task force put together. This is exactly to the point that you're saying. This is not a one size fits all. And candidly, we did not do well by at least one generation, if not two decades of students coming up, by saying you must go to college or you won't be successful. Right. You know, a lot of kids are not cut out for that. Right. And put on the right pathway. We have tens of thousands of vacant jobs today, middle level skilled jobs, like those electricians, those plumbers, the trades, right? Where you can't fill those jobs, and they pay middle income wages where you could afford to live, work, and raise a family in New Jersey.
Right. Union benefits and all that type of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. So our report talks to that and the importance that we get back there. And again, and this is the whole thing of being honest. Look, I have now 27-year-old twins, right? When they were coming up, I did the, you know, you will go to college. When I went to law school, I'm a lifelong learner. I believe in the value of education.
Right.
But you know what? It doesn't have to be like this, right? That trajectory that we all follow, right? You can step on and off. You can get credentials and you can get certificates that say, I know how to make or build or run this widget.
Right.
And I can work with that, right? I can make some money, and then I can continue to build those credentials toward a degree.
Right.
That's the real way. And that's an affordable way to get a post-secondary education. We have that challenge.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I think with all this stuff going on in the pandemic, I think a lot of parents and children are coming to the reality of, hey, you know what? If I can't go back to school this fall because the school's not open, I got to do an online learning. What am I paying $50,000 for and incurring debt to sit home and learn online when I can take some courses at UCC, or I can go to Rutgers, or I can go to Kane or Montclair State or whatever, and maybe even work at the same time and develop some skills, not end up $300,000 or $400,000 in debt. And, you know, it's just, I think it's the whole situation has been very eye opening. I think for a lot of parents who end up with, you know, I could end up with $1 million of debt or $700,000 of debt from my three kids at the end of the day. And it's very frustrating to feel like you're stuck. And there's also no, I think you would agree, there's no correlation with success and the people that went to college versus the people that took other routes. It's just all over the board.
And again, this is why I always say lifelong learning. I believe that no matter what your vocation, you should always be aspiring for the next level of your skill or your trade or whatever your credential is.
Right, right. So it's a crazy question, but how's your life changed dealing with all this stuff, and what you're seeing, and you know what your whole view is on this whole situation with the coronavirus?
Yeah, so we really from day one we pivoted to the resource side of what we do. Now, please let me say on the policy side, I mean, we're leading a coalition of 80 business associations and nonprofits on policy pronouncements every day.
Right.
We issued a recovery framework document with sector-specific best practices in order to help for the responsible opening of New Jersey's economy, because all of our business, first and foremost, is the health and welfare of their employees, their customers, their vendors, et cetera.
Right.
So we have to be able to open responsibly and safely. But on the business resource side, we became the 24/7 call center from day one. business needed somewhere to turn, we are a trusted advisor, not just, you know, to our members, but to just, you know, all business in the state. Right. At a time like this, at the beginning, there was no membership wall. We had to help everyone, because if all of our businesses aren't sustaining and healthy, then the economy doesn't come back and then our members don't.
Yeah. Now, the way they're calling you about all the programs that were coming out, the CARES Act, the PPP loans, everything, right?
We have an extremely vibrant and dynamic resource page that we update by the hour. And in the very beginning of this, we were very, very good on our communication for our members, daily feeding them what they need. And people are starved for information, right? Like when you're staring at an abyss and you just don't know where to go, you just need a trusted advisor, right? And we were just that trusted soul, because the information we were giving them was in real time, relevant, and hands-on.
Right. And there's a lot of stuff out there that was changing and conflicting. And you hear from one person, says, you're self-employed, you can't apply for this. And then you'd find out you could, and you missed the deadline, or the website didn't work. I mean, it was just nuts.
Very extremely challenging. I mean, the stories, we've taken thousands of calls over the last 7 weeks. And the stories, personally, I mean, when I say call center, I was taking this.
You were on the phone too?
On the phone, all day, all night. I had, you know, business owners crying. I had people who've never been on unemployment in their life, don't know what to do, right? Yeah. And sometimes, I might not be able to help them because they have to wait in the queue. Just hearing them, you know how many people said to me, you're the first person who called me back.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I just need to talk to someone and know someone hears me out there, right?
Yeah, on the unemployment side, for both employees and I guess for self-employed individuals, the whole state website's been a shit show. It's been crashing. You can't get in. You put your information that says we can't process you at this time. So you think your information's wrong, but it's not. And then you call and it says we have too many calls. You got to call back the next business day, and it's a Friday. Well, that's Monday. And then, because I hear from it all the time, from all the calls I'm on and the people that are calling me, and because they think when you're a lawyer, I'm sure you've had this over your career, that you know everything about every part of the law. And I'm like, I don't, but I can tell you what I do know. And you got it.
Yeah. I mean, the challenge was the demand. In all fairness, I have to tell you that the commissioner of the Department of Labor, Commissioner Sarah Angelo, I mean, he's handled this with grace and poise, and he's been extremely transparent about the challenges that they had and tried to manage the expectations. And so we tried to be that liaison, also managing the expectations and saying to folks, look, you're going to have to wait in line. I know it's not the answer you want, but you are going to get 100% of what you are entitled to, so long as you are entitled to it.
Right. I've seen that they've changed the windows for people to certify down to 30 minutes, because I think they had it in an hour blocks. I guess there was too many people. So they've been trying to push them to the little block so they don't overwhelm the system.
It's a million people.
Yeah.
It's a million people pounding on one system, you know?
Right. So now here's the tough question, and I wanted to get your opinion on it, because I have my own opinions about it. I deal with a lot of small local business owners. I see the economic impact being so much greater than the health impact. And obviously, if we don't manage the health impact well, it'll have more of an economic impact on everybody, because then we're back home again. But I'm concerned about a lot of the local business owners that I work with they own a restaurant, and they were just paying their bills before. They weren't getting rich, but it was a lifestyle business. They were paying their bills. They were going on vacation with their family. They put their kids through college, but now they couldn't take off for 2 months. Most of us couldn't. Michelle, you can take a 2 month vacation. You're like, I can't do that. So where do you see this going? I'm afraid that a lot of the small business owners, retail shops and restaurants may not open. Yeah. Because they can't operate at a 25% or 50% capacity, you know?
So we just completed a survey that we put out last week. And basically, you know, the top line takeaway and observation was that the good news is over 70% of New Jersey business can come back and operate in a safe manner, meaning they can operate their business with social distancing, CDC guidance, you know, things like that.
Without cutting their business, like
they can do it. Right. But the challenge is, more than not, 50% capacity to open, it doesn't work for them.
And operate, right?
They can't meet their expenses. There's not enough revenue. And for many, they said it would take them up to a year in order to get back to equilibrium. And I'm afraid of how many will lose as a result of that.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at a restaurant, if they got a social distance, they can take half as many people, so they have half as much staff, they're buying half as much food, and their expenses, unless the landlord's giving them a break, their expenses probably don't go down that much. Doesn't drop in half.
Yeah. Now the overhead, and then you have additional costs, because now you have to provide personal protective equipment.
Right.
You probably have to put like markers down and things. You have to buy stuff. You may even have to like make a capital improvement, such as like moving a wall or building a barrier somewhere, right? And these are real expenses. And think about getting your inventory back up, right? If all of a sudden, like, and that's why you can't flip a switch. We need planning because people need time to get the inventory in place. If everybody makes a demand for one product at one time, right, the cost of that product's going to be astronomical. Of course. Business is going to need some startup operating grants.
Yeah. You
know, for those first couple of weeks while
like restaurants, they don't have food left. They can't keep it for 3 months.
And alcohol. I mean, that whole thing. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's craziness. I think that we're going to see a lot of, I hope creative, but I think we're going to see a lot of ripple effects with different industries as it starts to, you know, get open. So I don't know. It's frightening for me. I mean, it's funny. At the beginning, as a small business attorney, I was like, oh, I'm out of business. And what am I going to do? I mean, I applied for everything too, but it's a lot of pent up demand. I think as we start to open, a lot of people are going to need legal advice and legal help. And so hopefully that'll, you know, save me, but I wouldn't want to be a restaurateur right now. I'd be very frightened about it, you know?
No, it's very difficult. And again, the industries have come up with their best practices on the what and the how, right? So, you know, if you can operate safely, we need to talk about, okay, if you can operate safely and you can follow these guidelines, how long are we going to wait until we enable you to be able to do that? And so, we know it'll be gradual. It's going to be slow. It's going to be conservative. Look, we're the, you know, second most impacted state in the nation. Okay. And you can't ignore that, right?
No.
The other piece of this too is not a one size fits all. We should be looking geography, right? We've got our tourism season coming up.
Right.
How do we get the shore towns to have some semblance of a season so that they can have some income, not be devastated?
Yeah. Right. No, I imagine community pools are going to be closed. Camps are going to be closed. I mean, you're going to send your kid to sleepaway camp and stuff them in a cabin for the summer. I can't imagine, even if they're open, that you want to do that.
And that's the challenge. Now, you know, today the governor announced that schools are not opening for the rest of the school year.
Yeah.
So what that means is if business opens, we still have parents who can't come back to work if they have young children who need childcare.
Right.
That's real.
Yeah.
And that is a covered eligible instance for unemployment insurance, is that if you have to stay home to tend to a child who's closed because of COVID, you collect unemployment.
Yeah. And that's more drain on the system. Right.
And difficult to bring the employees back. Like, we need a workforce to be able to come back. So that's going to be a challenge to get them back.
I wonder if there's going to be a big draw on workers' comp too, if people get sick at work, because it is, I guess that's a workers' comp claim, right?
There's legislation being contemplated right now about how do you address that fairly to everybody, okay? Right. Someone who's injured at the workplace, always, you know, there needs to be consideration for that. But how do you do it in a way to, especially if the business was operating according to guidance and direction, right? They did everything they're supposed to do. And now you're going to hold them, you're going to have a presumption that perhaps, you know, they quit it there. You can't bankrupt the system either.
Right.
We just have to, again, and thrilled at the discussions that are going on this, you know, very interactive discussions with our policymakers. They do understand the unintended consequences of these things. So
now, are there discussions, I'm not that the state can afford to do this, but are there discussions about additional funding programs for people like restaurants or like local businesses that need to purchase inventory and to keep stay open to help them through a 90 to 180 day period?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we are advocating for at the federal level is that any next tranche of money has to have money in it directly geared toward business for startup operating costs. And there is federal money in the state right now. Our CARES Act tranche is literally sitting in the state, you know, today, the $1.3 billion. An appropriate use of some of that money is toward business support. The money isn't being spent right now while the state waits to see whether or not they can use it for other operational expense.
You know, I did a little 15-minute thing on Facebook every Tuesday and Thursday. Well, I'm dropping to Thursdays. Twice a week was too much to think of a topic. But I spoke to a group the other day, and I spoke about it a couple of weeks ago. I think there may be an opportunity for people that have money, that maybe don't own a local business, they're executives or whatever, to invest in local businesses. I mean, like almost like private equity in local businesses that don't really have access to angel investors and VC capital. They don't have access to that money. But maybe, you know, somebody puts money into the local restaurant, they get a 50% stake, and there's a 5 to 7 year exit strategy when the business now is bankable and has cash flow and can refinance them out. So I'm trying to see if there's people out there. I don't unfortunately have the capital, but if there's people out there, which is why I put it out there, who want to, you know, get together, you got to do it from a legal standpoint, make sure everybody's protected and see if it works.
There are mechanisms for that. I mean, you know, the opportunity zones are meant to be exactly that.
Yeah.
You know, the opportunity zone program is meant to say to people, invest in your community. Right. And you will reap a return, you know, over time.
Yeah, that was a way for people to attract investors into larger projects. Yeah.
And then the other piece too, you know, EDA has some programs out there now for community development funds. We do have community development and redevelopment funds, and so there are programs operating through those as well. Again, if it's just state money, it's going to be small. We don't have a lot of money in the state. You know, right. EDA took the money on their, you know, on their own books, not state operating dollars, to do the grant and the loan program, and that was oversubscribed 5 times. That's why we're advocating for when dollars come in to put them into the EDA, because that is the state's bank for business, and they can push this money out really quickly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think, well, does a lot of that money go to, you know, areas like Elizabeth and Union and Trenton and those kind of areas? Or are you talking about more of the urban, the suburban?
Well, there's a bunch of different pots of money. So in that first CARES Act funding that came to the states, mm-hmm. right? There was $3 billion that came to New Jersey, right? But of that $3 billion, there were aspects of it that were earmarked. So there was money that was specifically earmarked for certain cities, okay, which is some of those highly populated cities, to go directly to them and block grants, community development block grants, right? And then there was this $1.3 billion, which is like for the state to determine how they'll spend. But there was a host of earmarks of how that money should flow out.
And is there still money left from the last CARES Act, or is that all gone now again?
No, the governor hasn't spent any of it, any of his $1.3 billion, because he's awaiting guidance on whether or not any aspect of that money can be used toward operating funds.
For the state?
Yes.
Now,
yes.
But when we got funded again, like last Monday, I think, for businesses, and people could reapply.
So that was the payroll protection.
Right. Is that, did that run out of money again?
You know, as we heard today, I think there was actually still some money, but there were a lot of people giving back money.
Right.
That program is a challenging program. It looks really good on its face, like really good on its face.
Yeah.
Problem is the timing aspects of it.
Right.
Because in order to get the loan forgiveness, you have to keep your staff at the same levels, right? It doesn't have to be the exact same people, but the same levels.
Right,
on the payroll for 8 weeks,
yeah.
And that has to all be before June 30th.
Yeah, business owners told me that they got a problem. They laid off half their staff. They're not going to be able to hire them back right away, you know?
And if they, right. And the idea of the program was to keep people off of unemployment. So literally, federal government was saying, I'm going to give you money to pay them.
Right.
Right? Even if you're not operating, so that you can continue to give them benefits, almost like a furlough, like we're going to fund the furlough.
Right.
But the problem is, you use that 8 weeks, and if we're not open in those 8 weeks, or we're only open for half, you've paid them to stay home, and now when you open the doors, you have no money to pay them for when they're actually working, given right. the current timelines. So that's a problem. So we're advocating for them to change those timelines and for flexibility in the program, so that money can be carried forward, or else we're going to have a lot of people who are going to wind up with a loan that isn't forgivable that they can't afford, and that'll be a travesty.
Everything always works in theory. And then it's when you start doing it, the money doesn't come out quick enough, and these people lay off, and they don't think like, well, they're going to have half the staff, and it just never works. I mean, it's too many people with too many opinions, I think.
No, and things that look good have unintended consequences. So the additional $600 in unemployment, isn't that, I mean, that's great. You're giving an additional $600, you know, a week to folks on unemployment, recognizing how challenging this time is. You know the unintended consequence of that? You have people making more in unemployment than they make working.
Yeah.
How are they going to go back?
I also understand that even if you're working part-time, so you'd get part unemployment, you get the full federal subsidy, right? There's no offset.
I think that's correct.
They just never talk about it.
That's one of those unintended consequences. And then you have an employer who wants to do what's best for their employees. And they literally are sitting there grappling going, why would I open and bring them back to pay them less when my staff can make more money over here? It's a very challenging scenario.
Yeah, it's true. I don't know if there's any good answers, but I guess we'll have to see how that plays out. I also don't know anybody who got the 600 yet.
Yeah.
I guess some people got the 600. I know a lot of people that haven't gotten it. You do?
Yeah, it actually started to flow a few weeks ago for those who are regular unemployment. For the PUA program, which is the Independent Contractors and Sole Proprietors in New Jersey, that program just opened up the end of last week. And they said your first payments would be, you know, this week, and then that $600 will come on the back of that. But again, you'll get everything you're entitled to. It'll just be delayed.
Yeah, it's a question of, you know, but luckily, unlike 08, when the banks were all hiding because they caused all these problems, everyone's been, you know, accommodating, like your utility companies have been putting things off and your insurance companies are giving you time. And, you know, everybody's kind of working together because we're all in this thing together.
You know, the world stopped. How many times have we said, if only the world would stop so that we could plan this, right? The world stopped.
Yeah, that wasn't a good thing. You got what you wished for.
Exact same situation, right? So from a competitive perspective, you know, if you don't kind of jump in and help to row the boat together, right? We're literally all sitting in that boat together.
Yeah. So as one of the leaders of the largest business and industry association in the country, where do you see us going from here? Like, it's obviously a new normal, right? But we don't know what that is. What are the changes that you're hearing that are going to happen as to how we deal with, you know, global economies and everything like that? I'm just curious as to what you've heard that's out. Yeah.
Well, I first of all, I think that the business model is going to change dramatically. You know, again, that micro level, that boots on the ground level, business model is going to change. People are going to see that there are some efficiencies to remote work and that people can be productive and effective in remote work. And I think that's going to have a strain on real estate. So it'll be interesting.
Office space. Yeah. If you're in warehousing, it's probably great, but office space is going to be a problem.
I think it's going to be a problem because now you're saying to folks, not only do you have to like social distance in that office space, right? So what are you doing? You know, so I think people are going to, and then the other part of it is I think that employees are going to be pushing for that as well.
Right. Because they want to. The younger people do anyway, Generation Z, they all want to work from home.
All this is doing is taking what was already a changing business model and expediting it.
Very much.
The whole idea of the role of technology was catching up quicker than people could handle. And now business owners are going to have to just embrace it and lean into it quicker.
Yeah, everybody got like a crash course in Zoom. Now they're all online. We had to get all at Easter. I had to get all my relatives online. They were 80 years old and they couldn't fit. But we got them going, you know. And so now it's becoming normal. And I also think that, you know, look, we're coming out of a problem where people haven't made money for several months. So a company's not going to like take more office space so they can spread out their employees. They're going to look for ways to work them at home with less office space to do that social distancing. And I think it's going to have a big impact on, I don't know, see people will be dumping buildings. So the values are going to drop.
Yeah. I mean, people just, they're going to look, everybody's going to go to the expense side of their ledger and say, before I cut people, what else can I do to change?
What's their biggest expense? Rent.
Exactly. So that's definitely going to be a change in business model. You know, even the retail, bricks and mortar and restaurants. Okay, restaurants. You know, how many have pivoted to this amazing way to deliver,
right?
Or do curbside pickup, putting together unique meals or kits, or you know, because people want to support their locals and people still want to have you know a meal from their favorite restaurant. It makes them feel good.
Go ahead.
No, I'm saying, so they're going to continue to do that, you know? Yeah. So maybe if they open 50%, but they keep that curbside delivery pickup going as well, they can hopefully by volume make up.
We went for the kids wanted Chinese yesterday. So it's Sunday. So I must've called four places, two of which I knew were open, but they couldn't even answer the phone, right? Cause it's so busy. So we found a place in Scotch Plains that we've been to before. So I go there to get the food. I walk in and their vestibule is like, it's all plasticked off. They got a little slot for you to slide the thing in. They built this big box so they could put the food in, slide it across, and do the whole social. I mean, they were ready for this thing. And then they had a sign said for all. They were giving all their tips to first responders.
Nice.
You know, on the healthcare. Yeah. So, I mean, they were ready for this thing. So, you're right. It's going to be. I don't know. Some of it's fear. Some of it's different in terms of the way they do business. But we'll have to see what happens in terms of the whole takeout and pickup. I had always, you know, it's funny. I'd always felt that retail, pandemic aside, was kind of going in the direction of you go to a store, maybe there's one or two items on the shelf. You try them on, you look at them, you like them, you buy it. It ships from somewhere else. You don't even leave the store with the item because it's going to be to your house before you get home. And I think that's going to be a way that retailers can consolidate. They don't have to keep the kind of inventory there, that it could be in a warehouse somewhere.
Yes.
And I think that you're going to see more of that, just like you said, because I said to everybody, oh my God, this is going to kill the retail office space business. They're like, why? I go, because how can you, you can't double your space. So you spread your employees out. You're going to be looking ways to save money. And that's the only way to do it.
And again, the, you know, the businesses are going to act and react in a way to make sure that their customers and their employees feel safe.
Yeah.
People aren't going to show up, right? Build it, they will come. We could say, you know, everything's open tomorrow, but if people don't feel safe and comfortable, they're not going to show up. And
so you're going to a football game with 80,000 people?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to go to a football game with 80,000 people now? Even with the vaccine, you still think twice about it. I'm worried about what it's going to do also to the, you know, to our mass transit systems when, you know, we're at 95% of the people aren't traveling and I can need as many trains and it's, the revenue is not going
to
be.
Yeah, but we're going to, but you know what, for the workforce, I mean, we have to, you know, in our policy documents, you know, we call for transit in a safe manner. Again, figure out, you know, you may need to have an extra train actually run because you don't put half the amount.
So. Right. But then that costs money, right? So then it's got to be reflected somewhere.
Yeah.
So we'll see. So Michelle, it's crazy times.
If you like our podcast, please tell others about us. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review and feel free to share our episodes on social media. If you have any questions or comments, ideas for the show, or you'd even like to appear as a guest, reach out to us by email at bindlaw33@gmail.com. That's bindlaw33@gmail.com. The Accidental Entrepreneur has been written, directed, and produced by Mitchell Beinacker. If you'd like more information about Mitchell and his practice, you can find him on social media or visit his website at beinackerlaw.com. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to our feed to be notified of all future episodes.